Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the Trump campaign's claim on British TV today that hidden or undercover voters will come out of the woodwork to elect Trump in November, and examine the influence of the alt-right on the campaign now that it is headed by Stephen Bannon, who boasted his Breitbart Media is the platform for the alt-right. Dan Cassino, a professor of political science at Fairleigh Dickinson University and author of Fox News and American Politics, How One Channel Shapes American Politics and Society, joins us to discuss how a sense of injured white identity defines the alt-right, whose founding myth is that the disadvantaged groups in American politics, minority voters, are actually running things through a combination of fraud and intimidation that ends up oppressing white men. Then we'll be joined in the studio by Lisa Graves, the Executive Director of the Center for Media and Democracy, who served as a senior advisor in all three branches of the federal government, as Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Justice Department, as Chief Counsel for nominations on the Senate Judiciary Committee, and as Deputy Chief at the U.S. Courts. We will discuss the Koch brothers' connections to Mike Pence and the lack of moral fiber on the Republican side in accepting Donald Trump as their nominee, as well as complacency amongst liberals and progressives who were alarmed by the prospect of Reagan and George W. Bush, but don't seem to recognize that the danger Trump poses is off the charts compared to them. Then finally, we will speak with Jonathan Dahman, a former correspondent for Newsweek who covered the presidential campaigns of John Kerry and Hillary Clinton for Newsweek and is the author of Landslide, LBJ and Ronald Reagan and the Dawn of a New America. He joins us to discuss whether the current double-digit lead that Clinton has in some polls is likely to shrink, as no presidential candidate since Ronald Reagan, who beat Walter Mondale by 18 points in 1984, has won the presidency by a wide margin. And joining us now is Dan Cassino, who is a professor of political science at Fairleigh Dickinson University, who also serves as director of experimental research for the university's independent research group, Public Mind. His latest book just out is Fox News and American Politics, How One Channel Shapes American Politics and Society. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dan Cassino.
It's great to talk with you, Ian.
Well, certainly at this point, the one channel, Fox News, is the only channel that Donald Trump is appearing on. He's pretty much boycotting the rest of them, at MSNBC and CNN, and the main networks. So that's in itself pretty extraordinary, isn't it?
Well, it's not entirely unprecedented. We have had candidates in the past refuse to talk to news channels, and it's not unprecedented, because this is almost exactly the strategy Richard Nixon adopted, where he was very careful in the 1968 campaign about choosing exactly to whom he would speak and when, basically to make sure he wasn't getting any questions he didn't want to answer. The other thing that's working against Trump here is the fact that the other channels, CNN, MSNBC, and the networks, basically revised their policies to no longer allow him to do call-ins. So they say, well, if you want to be on the air, we want to actually have you on the air, rather than call in to Morning Joe or call into the Today Show, as he was doing during the primaries, where Fox, Sean Hannity's fine with just letting him call in. So he's much more comfortable doing that.
Well, apparently on Thursday in Nevada, Hillary Clinton is going to deliver a speech to talk about, quoting the campaign, the disturbing alt-right political philosophy. That's alternative, short for alternative right. The disturbing political alt-right political philosophy and what she believes is a divisive and dystopian view of America. What do you think has prompted that? Obviously, the fact that Stephen Bannon has been put in charge of Trump's campaign and Breitbart News. He himself, Stephen Bannon, at the Republican National Convention, told a reporter from Mother Jones, Sarah Posner, that he essentially created the alt-right.
I think he's probably stretching a little bit to say he created it. However, Breitbart News, really since the death of Andrew Breitbart, when Bannon took it over, has become one of the major sources of the alt-right. What we have to do with the alt-right is we have to separate out really into two different areas. So there's two different core beliefs in the alt-right. The first is that minority groups, what they would refer to as special interest groups, basically anyone who's not a white male Christian, so we're talking about women, African-Americans, Muslims, Jews, homosexuals, transgender people are getting special rights and special treatment in America at the expense of white Christian male Americans. And second is that the idea that those people are using fraud and corruption in order to get these sort of benefits from the government. And Breitbart, prior to Breitbart's death, was much more focusing on the second part. Most people probably heard about Breitbart for the first time when they were looking at those undercover videos from Acorn. Well, that was funded by Breitbart, and Breitbart was at that point focusing on the second part, the corruption, the idea that liberals are corrupting the political system and using our tax dollars to do nefarious ends to benefit these what they see as special interest groups. After Breitbart died and Bannon took over, we saw Breitbart shift to including the first part, this idea of discrimination against Christians, discrimination against men, discrimination against whites, as a way of linking those together and really creating a much more coherent political ideology out of it. Because if all you're saying is, well, the government's corrupt, well, it's not necessarily clear why it's corrupt, who's doing the corruption, and it becomes very much pox on all their houses sort of movement, which is actually very much what we got out of the Tea Party. Once you add in that first element back into it, the parts, you know, the part about discrimination against white men, the part that really before had been part of what we were seeing in far-right fringe movements, you know, white power sort of movements, once you bring that in, you're able to create a much more coherent political ideology. And we've actually seen that in the survey data. That is, 8 years ago and 4 years ago, in 2008 and 2012 data we have, you didn't see much of a unification of people with racial resentment, economic resentment, and gender-based resentment. And by 2016, we're seeing all of those seem to be forming one dimension. That is, people who, in the past, people who were against gay rights weren't necessarily showing levels of racial resentment, thinking that blacks are being treated better by the government, for example. By 2016, we see that those attitudes are starting to merge, and we're getting one coherent political dimension that very much looks like the alt-right.
And again, I'm speaking with Dan Cassina, who's a professor of political science at Fairleigh Dickinson University, who also serves as director of experimental research for the university's independent research group, Public Mind. His latest book just out is Fox News and American Politics, How One Channel Shapes American Politics and Society. Now, I think I mischaracterized what Steve Bannon said at the RNC. He actually said that Breitbart was the platform for the alt-right. And the person, if anybody created it, I think he could go back to Richard Spencer, who was the head of the National Policy Institute, which is a white nationalist think tank. In 2008, he popularized the term alt-right. And of course, Spencer himself is a pretty, well, I don't know. I won't characterize who he is, but he believes that white Americans need to resist our dispossession, believes that a nation for everyone becomes a nation for no one, and he advocates removing blacks, Hispanics, and Jews from the United States. So where does Spencer fit in this kind of universe of white nationalism?
Well, what we're seeing here is the mainstreaming of these views. So here's an example of how this comes mainstream. In 2012, for the first time ever, we actually asked in the American National Election Survey whether men were being discriminated against, which seems like an odd thing to ask Americans, why we hadn't asked it before. And we found that somewhere around 20% of Republicans in 2012 said that men were being discriminated against in America. In 2016, that number more than doubled. We're up to about 45% of Republican men say that men are facing discrimination in America. The idea here is that all of the white men, driven largely by economic resentment, are now accepting all of these views that were previously very, very fringe views that were held by mostly by white nationalists. The idea that Jews and women and homosexuals are corrupting the political system and getting all of these extra benefits from it, that was not something we were seeing in the mainstream ideology before. But what's happened is that we have enormous levels of economic resentment in a way we haven't seen previously since we've been doing these studies going back to the 1960s. And by economic resentment, I mean people saying that the economic system is rigged against them, that people like them cannot find a job. And that level of sort of economic resentment, which we saw largely coming out of the 2008 recession, where early on in the recession was sociologists called a man session. It was all white men basically losing their jobs. Once they lost those jobs, they had to find someone to blame for it. And that has led to this racial resentment, this gender-based resentment, all these other resentments coming forward. So the people have been trying to sell this alt-right ideology for 20 or 30 or more years. And Pat Buchanan has been trying to sell it personally on TV for 20 years, and it never got any traction until very recently. And it turns out what was missing was that sort of economic crisis, the economic resentment, where white, blue-collar men no longer feel like they can get ahead in society. And once they feel that way, they have to have someone to blame. And what we're seeing is increasingly they are blaming what they see as special interest groups. They're blaming women. They're blaming Latinos. They're blaming the Chinese. But they're also bringing all these other groups. And that's what's most troubling to me in this, is that we're seeing higher levels, for instance, of anti-Semitism, which is something we actually took off most of these surveys somewhere in the 1980s because no one was admitting to anti-Semitic attitudes anymore. And we're now seeing people on surveys saying that Jews tend to stick together, that Jews are greedy. And these are things that people 30 years ago at least knew not to say, even if they thought, but it's now becoming mainstream enough that people are willing to say this to an interviewer, to say things about blacks, about Jews, about homosexuals, that they simply weren't socially acceptable before.
Well, that's what's sort of interesting about the way this campaign shakeup of Trump's would indicate to me. On the one hand, he's got Kellyanne Conway encouraging him to reach out to African-American voters, although he delivers his speeches in front of entirely white audiences when he reaches out to African-Americans. And my sense is that since he's not really talking to African-Americans and certainly not going to their neighborhoods, it would indicate to me that he's just essentially assuaging white middle-class conservative voters that you're not racist. And then on the other hand, today, Trump talked about undercover voters swinging the election for him. And undercover voters seems to be the people that Stephen Bannon has organized. And these are the far-right voters who don't want to talk to pollsters and who are essentially, you've just characterized some of their unfortunate characteristics. So is that what's going on here, that this new shakeup is a sort of, he's appealing to one group, assuaging the fact that they're not racist, and another group, he's speaking to them in a kind of dog whistle way, saying, "You guys are my undercover voters, and you're going to come out and surprise everybody."
Well, so we have to put a couple things. First off, no one's actually going to go to African-American neighborhoods. No Republican's going to go to African-American neighborhoods and campaign there, because George Romney tried that in 1964, and it was an unmitigated disaster. And he went on what was called a ghetto tour, and it was it's considered one of the worst flubs in recent American presidential political history. So no one's going to try and repeat that. I think you're absolutely right. He's trying to assuage voters, saying, look, I'm not racist. You can feel comfortable voting for me. But we're also seeing, I think, this looks like desperation moves on the part of the campaign, because we're getting these, as you say, a very schizophrenic message. We're getting three or four different sets of messages. On one hand, you've got Bannon, who is all about saying, going back to Richard Nixon in 1968, the Republican Party has used dog whistles. Say, look, we're not going to say anything explicitly racist, but we're going to talk about law and order, which is a way of saying, we're going to basically keep African Americans in line. And so we're going to use those dog whistles. But then we've got Bannon, who comes and says, no, we shouldn't use dog whistles. We should talk about what we really mean, which is very much where Trump has been. I'm just going to say what I think, and if it's politically incorrect, as they say, well, then that's your problem, not mine. So on that side, we've got Trump trying to not use dog whistles. On the other hand, we have Kellyanne Conway, who is much more of a moderate, who's much more of an established Republican pollster. And she's looking and saying, boy, we have to get our base together at least. Step one, get your base together. So we have to bring in moderate Republicans. So she's trying to do the same time. So Trump is in the unenviable position of trying to use dog whistles at rallies to excite the base, because that's what his base wants, this alt-right base you're talking about, which is not that much of the vote, but it's there. And on the other hand, trying to have Kellyanne Conway go and say, no, we need to get the moderates as well. And you can't do both, at least not without a very finely tuned message, which is something Trump has not really shown an ability to do. As far as the undercover voters, Kellyanne Conway is a very smart person. She knows that that's not true. She knows it's not real. And when she's pressed on, she says, well, I can't talk about how we know this or where it comes from. And this is, we've heard this before from pollsters who are working for candidates, because if you're a pollster working for a candidate, you can't get up on TV and say, yeah, we're losing big. You can't do it. I remember at the pollsters convention a few years ago, Mark Blumenthal was asked about the fact, boy, you kept on saying you were head of, you know, in 2008 when he was writing Hillary Clinton, you're head of Obama. Why did you say it? He said, well, of course I'm going to lie. I mean, I can't say we're losing badly. So you have to find some way to deflect the fact that you're losing. Otherwise, you risk even further erosion of your base. So I think that is them just trying to find some way to report that they are not actually losing, because we have good metrics on this. We actually can tell from our polls when we've got these undercover voters. And the way we tell is we look at the number of times we have to call someone in order to actually get a response. So most high-level polls now, telephone polls, are going to do up to 8 calls to a number to try and get a response. And we are going to annoy the heck out of you to try and get a good sample. So we know when I've got undercover voters, I have voters who just don't want to talk to us, supporters of that candidate take more phone calls on average to pick up. And we see this. So, for instance, after President Obama's first debate with Mitt Romney, it was considered to be a disastrous debate for Obama, and suddenly Obama supporters were taking an extra 2 calls on average before they were picking up the phone. What that tells us is they are not enthusiastic about politics. They don't want to talk right now because they're feeling bad about their candidate. So that looks like undercover voters. We saw Obama's numbers drop. As it turns out, it wasn't actually a drop in Obama's numbers. It was a drop in the proportion of Obama voters that are willing to talk to pollsters. So if we look at Obama voters versus Clinton voters, I'm sorry, we look at Trump voters versus Clinton voters, we don't see any difference. Republicans are actually easier to get on the phone than Democrats are in general, and we don't see any deviation from that. The only group that we actually have real trouble getting on the phone this cycle is evangelical voters. They're always tough to get, and they're even tougher this cycle. But I find it bizarre to be speculating that it's actually a whole bunch of evangelicals really love Barack Obama, really love Donald Trump, but they're just not getting on the phone to tell us about it.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, let's turn to your book, Dan Cascino, Fox News and American Politics, How One Channel Shapes American Politics and Society. And Fox News, of course, its average primetime viewer now is about 68 years old. Apparently, the two boys that have taken over from their father, Rupert Murdoch, CEO James Murdoch, and executive co-chairman Lachlan, pretty much engineered this exit of Ailes. They want to get a younger demographic in there. But nevertheless, Fox News is still the most profitable part of Rupert Murdoch's media empire, and it generated about $1.63 billion in operating income this year, compared to CNN's $415.8 million and MSNBC's $228.4 million. And Fox News averages 2.26 million total viewers a night in prime time, whereas CNN has 1.23 million and MSNBC has 970,000. So by all of those metrics, it's a success. But it is still a part of a small universe, and that is, you know, it's sort of the Pravda of the Republican Party. And is it going to be able to make a shift, presumably, to the center under the two boys?
Well, so I've actually had a lot of people ask me this question lately. Do you expect Fox News to change? And I actually would go back to exactly what you said at the start. That is, Fox News is immensely profitable. And Rupert Murdoch, whatever his politics are, mostly cares about making money. And so it would seem odd to me to build the one media property in America that's actually running significant, reliable profits and change it so it might not make those profits again in the future. So I can't imagine that Lachlan and James are actually going to come in and actually change anything substantial, because they're making a lot of money now. It would seem silly to, you know, change horse in the stream when you're doing well. The big challenge Fox News is going to face under the new management is actually trying to get everyone on the same sheet. So this is something Roger Ailes was brilliant at, and perhaps is responsible for Fox News' influence. I mean, besides their ratings, they've been immensely influential on Republican politics. And part of the reason for that is because Roger Ailes would tell his hosts, this is what you're talking about, this is the terminology you're going to use, and using that strategy, using these talking points they put out on a daily basis, he was able to create new issues out of whole cloth. So in America Today, last time we polled it, which was in 2015, about 40% of Americans now say that they always or most of the time say Merry Christmas instead of saying Happy Holidays. In 2004, that was 8%. What changed? In December of 2004, Fox News decided they were going to make the war on Christmas a thing in order to help one of their hosts sell a book. And in that 10, 11 years, they were able to convince almost half the American public this was a real issue, because they were all talking about, the hosts were all talking about it and using the same terminology again and again. Fox News faced a very similar challenge when Barack Obama won the presidency in 2008 and took office in 2009. Basically, from that point, before 2001, Fox News wasn't really much of a force in American politics because they weren't in most homes, really, until about 2001. And from 2001 to 2009, they were operating as the spokespeople for the Bush administration, to the extent that the Bush administration just hired one of their hosts to be their spokesman because he was doing a better job than they could do themselves. But in 2009, they had to pivot, and they had to find a way to keep their viewers together and become the voice of the opposition. And they did this by letting go of social issues for the most part and focusing on foreign policy issues where they could get all their viewers together. So they talked about foreign policy at a much higher rate than any other news channel. Whatever you say about them, people say Americans don't want to see foreign policy news, see news about Syria and Iran. Fox News was showing that at three times the rate of CNN and MSNBC. And that was a way to keep their viewers together. What can all Republicans agree on? Barack Obama is going to destroy the world. Okay, so we've got something everyone can agree on. And we've seen several pivots over the years to try and avoid talking about divisive issues. So they weren't talking about trade, for instance, because trade is an issue where the Tea Party and establishment Republicans are very much at odds. So let's not talk about that. We're going to talk about Obamacare, which everyone can agree is a bad idea on that side of the spectrum. Regardless of how this election goes, the Fox News is going to have to make another pivot. It's actually a relatively easy one if Hillary Clinton wins. They become the anti-Clinton channel. But if Donald Trump actually manages to win, they've got a real problem on their hands with how do you change your messaging to reflect the channel's new role. What is the role of a channel? Of this channel in the Clinton presidency or in a Trump presidency? Do you just take the same playbook, go somewhere new? Moreover, even if you come up with a good play, can you actually get all of the anchors, many of whom had very strong built-in personal loyalty to Roger Ailes in their contracts to say they were allowed to leave if Ailes did, can you get them to stay on the same page in the same way that Ailes is doing? If you're not able to, you're going to wind up losing a lot of the influence that Fox News has had over the past 10 years.
Well, just in closing, though, everything you just described, you're not describing a news channel. You're describing a propaganda outlet.
I'm describing a way to make a news channel profitable, which is something they figured out and no one else did.
Right. But the idea that somebody would get all of the anchors on the same page, guide the news, work hand in glove with the Republican Party, decide to orchestrate opposition to an incumbent they didn't like, choose candidates they want to get elected, etc. It's not what news is normally about.
I'm a social scientist. Whether something is good or bad is above my pay grade. I just try and describe what happens and what the effects are.
Well, I think you did. And I thank you for joining us, Dan Cassino.
Pleasure talking with you, Ian.
Likewise. And again, I've been speaking with Dan Cassino, who's a professor of political science at Fairleigh Dickinson University, who also serves as director of experimental research at the university's independent research group, Public Mind. And his latest book just out is Fox News and American Politics, How One Channel Shapes American Politics and Society. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back joined in the studio by Lisa Graves, who will be discussing the Koch brothers' connections to Mike Pence.
There's room at the top, they are telling you still. But first you must learn how to smile when you kill. If you want to be like the folks on the hill. A working class hero.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now in the studio is Lisa Graves, who is the Executive Director of the Center for Media and Democracy and the publisher of alecexposed.org. She has served as a senior advisor in all three branches of the federal government, as Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Justice Department, as Chief Counsel for Nominations on the Senate Judiciary Committee, and as Deputy Chief at the U.S. Courts. Welcome to Background Briefing, Lisa Graves.
Thank you so much, Ian. It's so good to see you in person.
It is good. The last time we were in person was in Madison, Wisconsin. Wisconsin at WORT.
That's right. It was a great treat to see you in our home state.
Well, now you're in sunny California, so it's good to have you here. And what are you guys up to? What is the latest? Because, you know, you're a watchdog group and you dig up a lot of important information about the machinations of these political outsiders who are dominating our politics now, like the Koch brothers. So any smoking guns?
We have some news stories coming about the Koch brothers that I think you'll find very interesting. But one of them is about the dodge that basically they're giving to claim that they're not going to be involved in the presidential election because I guess they can't control Trump. And, you know, we have documented how Mike Pence is being advised by the former head of the Koch brothers, Freedom Partners. So that's a significant issue in terms of their connection, the connection of their infrastructure to the presidential campaign. But also, we've been tracking their activities in the states, and they're pushing very hard with their money and the money of their billionaire buddies on these Senate races to try to control the Senate. And I think they're about ready to go up, if they haven't gone up already, on new ads in Ohio, basically attacking Hillary in the guise of supporting the Republican candidate for the Senate there in Ohio. And so they're very active. They pledged last year that they were going to raise and spend $889 million. They've tried to downplay that figure over the last several months, but they've already spent at least $400 million of that investing in groups that are going to be very active, I'm sure, in the coming few months.
But Pence himself, the vice president, isn't he a Koch brothers and alumni?
Well, Mike Pence is someone who has been honored, as they say, by the American Legislative Exchange Council and claimed that he was part of that group before it was cool. That group, as you know, is a group where corporations, corporate lobbyists, actually vote as equals on so-called model bills with state legislators before they're introduced in our state houses. And so you have a group that describes itself as a charity, a tax write-off for these corporations, which is really creating resort vacations for legislators where they're wined and dined and schmoozed and boozed, and where they go behind closed doors away from the press or the public to vote on bills to help those corporations and then push them through our legislatures. So Mike Pence has been an ally of the organization. He pushed through a lot of the disastrous ALEC policies in Indiana. And as we've documented, ALEC is largely supported by the Koch brothers. So their family fortune is one of the biggest funders of the ALEC operation, along with some of the big oil and gas companies, Exxon and others, big tobacco and some other big global corporations.
So I find it extraordinary how Pence and all of the other Republicans, your Wisconsins, Wisconsinites, Ryan Spreebus, right, and Paul Ryan, how they continue to make excuses for Trump and how they make excuses for their own lack of moral fortitude to recognize that he is such an outlier. This is such an outrage that somebody like this is running for president. I mean, I know I sound partisan, but I really do believe that I'm being objective in saying this man is a catastrophe for various reasons. Some people even question his mental health, his extreme narcissism, his business record of ripping off people, and his arrogance of not even wanting to show his tax returns or anything while he's attacking Hillary Clinton, calling the Clinton Foundation the most corrupt enterprise in the history of politics. I mean, we're going, that's a big statement. So, you know, they say more or less the excuse is, well, we got to vote for him because otherwise the Supreme Court will turn liberal for millennia and we'll be finished in terms of our conservative agenda. So that seems to be an extraordinarily weak excuse to put this reckless, unstable person in the White House for 4 years, you know, just because of the courts. I mean, where is the morality here in terms of just simple recognition that most people should have? That this, we haven't seen anything like this. I mean, people, you know, liberals really thought that Ronald Reagan was a catastrophe. They thought that George W. Bush was a catastrophe. Compared to both of them, they both look like statesmen compared to this guy.
Well, I would say in my personal capacity that I am stunned and shocked by what's been happening in this country over this past year with this person who has now been nominated by the Republican Party to potentially become the president of the United States and potentially the most powerful person in the world, because I don't think you need to be a psychologist to recognize that he has extraordinary self-love, as they might say, that he is so impetuous. If you can't trust him on Twitter, how could you possibly trust him with weapons and war? And he's so vindictive in his comments and so prone to supporting violence. It's just hard to imagine that the people of the United States would support such a person. But in my organizational capacity at CMD, what we do is we document how corporations and people seek to influence our political system. And we certainly have seen, you know, a real divide in the Republican Party's stated goals or values and the claims being put forward by the candidate. In this instance, you, though, have a situation in which the right wing has really fed what they call this alt-right press. And now with a person from the Breitbart operation as a leading advisor to Trump, you have just this marriage with the most hateful right-wing outlets, basically, although supposedly that's all separate now. But you have people who have pushed such hatred for women, such hatred and disinformation about African Americans, about Black Americans in this country, such disinformation about immigrants, such disinformation about the news, that I think, you know, really in some ways that the way that the conservatives or so-called conservatives have ceded so much territory to this right-wing conspiracy world is just extraordinary, and now it's sort of coming home to roost. And I think that even though, you know, supposedly Trump is on some sort of do better campaign with his new team, with Kellyanne Conway, who is on the board of the Independent Women's Forum and these other groups, you know, a lot of that is just PR. We observe that PR in the campaign season. It's sort of shocking to see some of the more traditional press treat this as a natural pivot. I don't think this is a normal environment that we're observing. And quite frankly, when you see someone like Kellyanne Conway go on the news and claim things that are completely false, like Donald Trump doesn't attack other people, it's quite extraordinary. But it's not a surprise, quite frankly, given the role that she's played in various PR operations. She was someone who tried to help Richard Murdoch, you know, who was infamous for one of these statements back in 2012 in the Senate races about women and rape. She's someone who has advised Pence before. She's someone who's a professional spin master. And actually, one of the things I wanted to share with you is that we have a new report out about this group, the Independent Women's Forum and the Independent Women's Voice. We looked at the reported campaign donors to their spending in ads in the Scott Brown campaign and or to support him. And we discovered that the majority of the donors to the so-called Independent Women's Voice were men. Men like Foster Freeze. And so that was sort of a delicious, revealing result of our investigation of this group. So who is the Independent Women's Voice? It's men like Foster Freeze.
Well, yes, not men, but rich men.
Billionaires.
Billionaires, yes.
He calls himself a billionaire wannabe, Foster Freeze, who backed Santorum try to make his campaign relevant.
Right.
Yeah.
And again, I'm speaking with Lisa Graves, who is the executive director of the Center for Media and Democracy and the publisher of alecexposed.org. She has served as a senior advisor in all three branches of the federal government, as deputy assistant attorney general in the Justice Department, as chief counsel for nominations on the Senate Judiciary Committee, and as deputy chief at the U.S. courts. So given how Donald Trump is such an extraordinary break with American political tradition, that he is defying everybody by not releasing any information about his finances. We don't know who has his hooks into him. The latest expose by the New York Times indicates that he's in debt at least to $650 million to the Chinese Communist Bank. And of course, he rails against the Chinese all the time, and also to Goldman Sachs. And he goes after Hillary Clinton for her speaking fees when he owes them tens of millions. So we don't know who have their hooks into him. We don't know who finances his operations because he's been blackballed by U.S. banks. There's very little we know about him except because he sues everybody. But what we do know about him is pretty disgusting and pretty shocking. So my question is now, since we've talked about why aren't the Republicans showing some moral fiber here, in repudiating such a dangerous candidate. Why aren't liberals and progressives more motivated to stop him? I don't get, I mean, I know that a lot of people are disappointed in Hillary Clinton, particularly those who supported Bernie Sanders, but I'm just astounded that they don't get it. I mean, they really thought George W. Bush was terrible and Ronald Reagan was terrible, but this guy's in a whole different category.
Well, it's interesting to see the online debates and the sort of false equivalency or equivalency arguments going on about Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. And again, we don't take a position on candidates or campaigns. I'm actually surprised as an observer that Donald Trump has gotten away without releasing any of his past tax forms. For example, Kellyanne Conway, I think, inadvertently conceded that up to, I think, about 2008, his tax audit is over. So those could be released. They're not under audit, but they refused to release those. And she came on the air and claimed, she was repudiating her prior statements, calling for the reveal of those tax returns, saying that the audit is, quote, serious. I don't know why the IRS couldn't just suspend the audit temporarily and say this is just not an issue. These should be released. But also, I think that this issue of the transparency of the tax forms, it's a key issue in the American political tradition to have that revelation. Certainly, it's not a constitutional requirement that people disclose their tax forms. The constitutional requirements are very small. It's age and citizenship. But the idea that you have someone running for president who won't reveal this most basic information about, as you said, who they're in debt to, how much income they have, what the sources of their income are, is just extraordinary, especially when you have had these close advisors to Trump who have ties, very close ties, and continue some of them to have ties to the former Soviet Union, to kleptocrats in the former Soviet Union, in Russia, and other states. And you have a situation in which you have a Democratic nominee who has been criticized over email. There's a lot of back and forth over the practices of prior secretaries of state in terms of personal email.
And now the Clinton Foundation, which is, doing favors for the State Department. What is the State Department? The State Department, like all American government branches, is dedicated to taking care of the wealthy and the powerful. They're the people who buy and own our politics. That's what our politicians do. If you give $1 million to a candidate, you damn sure will get in the door before the regular constituents. And the idea that there's something going on at the State Department, when the State Department, most of its diplomats are political appointees,
right,
who have no
right.
All they've done is given money to the candidate.
Right.
I mean, this outrage that's going on about, oh my God, the influencing the State Department. Give us a break. That's how Washington works. Washington is pay to play.
Yeah, I hadn't really focused on the ambassadorships until like maybe 10 or 15 years ago. Maybe more than that. And I realized how many of them were donors, Republican or Democrat, doesn't matter who's in office. Wouldn't matter if Trump was in office, like he wouldn't appoint so-called diplomats who were not, his financial buddies or what have you. It's, it is a really unfortunate part of the pay-to-play system that is Washington. But the notion that either leading candidate would not have that process for the ambassadorships, it's just not real. But also, you have a person in Hillary Clinton, just from the policy standpoint, who has said that she's going to bring up an amendment to the Constitution to address the disaster decision of Citizens United within the first few months of her presidency if she were elected. That policy, the Citizens United impact, is a symptom of the underlying problems with our democracy, which is this extraordinary influence of the wealthiest people and the wealthiest corporations. I think that we need to get a handle on that. I don't think that the idea that this issue is just on one side of the political spectrum is true. The idea that it's only Hillary and not Trump, I think this is part of the problem. We need to have reforms that address retaking our democracy for ordinary people. And The attacks on her, I think, are symptomatic of the larger concerns that many Americans have about our political system.
Well, just in closing, it seems that Citizens United is, and that's what Bernie Sanders kept saying, unless you get money out of politics, you can't do a damn thing. You cannot reform anything in this country unless you take the money out and bring the people back in and no longer have the government of the 1% by the 1% and for the 1%. So clearly, Hillary Clinton, a constitutional amendment is a little bit chimeric because it takes forever and you've got to get 2/3 of the legislatures in 2/3 of the states. That's a big lift. But putting an extra couple of justices on the Supreme Court, you could overturn it with a stroke of a pen, couldn't you?
Right. And the Supreme Court, I think, is a crucial issue here because we've had so many years of this George W. Bush court that has just advanced corporate power to the detriment of ordinary people with Citizens United and other decisions, that's a huge crisis in our democracy. That's the true crisis in our democracy in many ways, is that this court has rubber-stamped the expansion of corporate power and CEO power in ways that have fundamentally undermined American democracy, which was not perfect before then in terms of the pay-to-play operations. It has put that on steroids, and it has to be addressed.
Well, Lisa Graves, I thank you very much for joining us in the studio.
Thank you so much, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Lisa Graves, who is Executive Director of the Center for Media and Democracy and the publisher of alecexposed.org. She has served as a senior advisor in all three branches of the federal government, as Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Justice Department, as Chief Counsel for nominations on the Senate Judiciary Committee, and as Deputy Chief at the U.S. Courts. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into how Hillary Clinton's current lead is likely to shrink since no presidential candidate since Ronald Reagan has won the presidency by a wide margin. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Jonathan Dahman, who's a writer based in New York City and a former correspondent for Newsweek, where he covered national politics, including John Kerry's presidential campaign in 2004 and Hillary Clinton's in 2008. His latest book is Landslide, LBJ and Ronald Reagan at the Dawn of a New America. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jonathan Dahman.
Thanks so much for having me.
And given that at the moment, in some polls, Hillary Clinton is ahead by double digits, although it does appear to be narrowing a little, the last person to win by double digits in the presidential race was Ronald Reagan in 1984, who beat Walter Mondale by 18 points. So in terms of the dawn of a new America, is that to say that in the new America, presidents don't win, they squeak by?
That's certainly the America that we've all been living in for quite some time. I think we've all been pretty much conditioned since 2000 and Bush v. Gore and the hanging chads in Florida to really plan on staying up late on election night and looking for it state by state. But the whole long era before that, with a couple of exceptions, really that was not the case. It was an era of big presidential wins where the outcome seemed pretty much assured in the weeks before the election, and there wasn't that much drama on election night. Right now, it looks like that could be more the model for this year, although, of course, as you always have to say, in August, a lot can happen overnight, let alone over a matter of months in politics. But if the current polling holds, Hillary Clinton could see a substantial substantial electoral college win, perhaps even bigger than the one that President Obama saw in 2008, and getting up towards some of the larger wins of the 20th century in the electoral college. I don't personally think that when we talk about the popular vote and the percentage of her victory, I don't think that would necessarily rival some of the biggest wins of the 20th century, the largest, of course, being Lyndon Johnson's in 1964 when he won nearly 61% of the popular vote.
But not too many presidents of late have even reached the 50% mark, right? George W. Bush did, Obama did twice, but that seems almost the exception.
Yeah, and one of the interesting things about this year, based on the polling that we've seen so far, is that it's quite conceivable that Hillary Clinton could have a substantial electoral college win, approaching a landslide without getting that high above 50% herself. Donald Trump is polling so poorly in a lot of the Republican states that traditionally bring in big numbers of voters, places like Utah and places like South Carolina and places like even Mississippi, where you expect just a huge Republican win, but there's a real lag in the sort of traditional Republican voter coming around to his side, which is depressing his numbers. And you combine that with the appeal that we see in some polls for the third-party candidates, the Libertarian Party and the Green Party, and Hillary Clinton is doing quite well in an awful lot of states without really getting that huge a majority for herself at all.
So what do you make of this claim that Kellyanne Conway made on British television today that Trump will win because of undercover voters? Have you ever heard of that before?
Yeah, I think it's always a bad sign if in August the best argument that a campaign has going for them is some sort of conspiracy in the polling or some major flaw, I guess I should say, in the polling. I don't know of too many reputable pollsters who really think that undercover Trump voters are going to be a dramatically big effect this year. I mean, I think the argument they're making is that voting for Donald Trump is somehow a socially stigmatized behavior, and it's not something that respectable people would want to necessarily admit to a pollster over the phone, but in the privacy of their own thoughts and in the privacy of the voting booth, they would go ahead and say, actually, I'm for that guy. I'm sure there are some voters like that, but I don't think that is a large enough category to really give us all a big surprise on Election Day. It's something that we have seen in races in the past, particularly when we're talking about minority candidates on ballots. There was the famous Bradley effect where in the past you've had voters tell a pollster that they're willing to vote for an African-American candidate, but then actually the candidate does much worse than their polling on Election Day because in the privacy of the voting booth, voters take a different path. But if that's the best case that the Donald Trump campaign has going for them, I think they're in a fair amount of trouble.
And the Bradley effect, of course, refers to the former mayor of Los Angeles who lost to Sam Yorty in a race that had Bradley way ahead in the polls. Again, I'm speaking with Jonathan Dahman, who's a writer based in New York City and a former correspondent for Newsweek, where he covered national politics, including John Kerry's presidential campaign in 2004 and Hillary Clinton's in 2008. And his latest book is Landslide, LBJ and Ronald Reagan at the Dawn of a New America. So why then do these races get so narrow, do you think? And, you know, it's the grist for the mill of all of these consultants and pollsters and focus group people who slice and dice it down to a fine point. In fact, there was a kind of satirical movie made with Kevin Costner that suggested that it could get so incredibly scientific and so accurate, all of this pre-election slicing and dicing, that you could end up with one person being the swing voter, as was the case in this movie. So what explains the narrowing of, even with Hillary Clinton ahead at the moment, I think it's wise to assume that she's not going to win by anything like the margin she has now.
Right. I think the phenomenon you describe is exactly the right way of putting it. I mean, the way that we've been conditioned to think about elections in the last few cycles is really the two parties, the Republicans and the Democrats, both can count on about 45 to 47% of the electorate going their way. And then really it's about, in the final push of the election, it's about doing two things. It's about making sure that their hardcore supporters actually come out and vote, and then it's winning over a very small sliver of the electorate that is still persuadable to go really with either side in the race. I think the change has to do most prominently with the shift in the partisan nature of our politics and the role of ideology in the two parties. So if you were to go back to 50 years ago, to 1964, when Lyndon Johnson won the largest popular vote landslide in American history, the two parties were much more heterogeneous in their geographical makeup, in their demographic makeup, and in their ideological makeup. So when you had a situation like 1964, which was in many ways quite similar to today, where you had a sort of standard issue, you know, Washington workhorse Democratic nominee in Lyndon Johnson, who, in some aspects of his biography, was not all that different from Hillary Clinton, and that he was a sort of prototypical insider, going up against a Republican candidate who seemed really almost, in a lot of people's eyes, disqualifyingly extreme in Barry Goldwater. And so when you were to say to a bunch of Republican voters in 1964, here's this extreme candidate, Barry Goldwater, who's unacceptable for the presidency, and those people agreed with that, and they weren't inclined to vote for Goldwater, there were a lot of things that they might actually like in the Democratic Party in 1964. If you were a Northeastern liberal or moderate Republican in 1964, and those people did exist, you not only wanted to vote against Barry Goldwater, you were fine with voting for Lyndon Johnson as the president who had signed the Civil Rights Act of 1964, and who really shared a vision of sort of responsible, good, activist government that could change people's lives and make a difference and create a very, you know, sort of optimistic future for the country. We don't see that anymore. The sort of hardcore beliefs in the Republican Party are diametrically opposed to the vision that gets promoted by the Democratic Party. So it really is a much bigger hurdle to convince a Republican voter this year not just to vote against Donald Trump, but to vote for the Democratic ticket. And that's why you really don't see the huge swings in the electorate that we saw in the past before the parties became so polarized.
Well, in 1964, of course, when Johnson swamped Barry Goldwater, 2 years later, as you write in your book, Richard Darman, Landslide, LBJ, and Ronald Reagan at the Dawn of a New America, 2 years later, there was a stinging rebuke in the 1966 midterms where the Democrats still held onto the Congress, but the Republicans picked up 47 seats in the House and 3 in the Senate. And that does seem to happen frequently. It happened, of course, in 2008. After the 2008 victory by Obama, 2 years later, there was a blowout, as we all know, and the Republicans picked up the House, and they pretty much, you know, have held it ever since, and people don't give the Democrats a lot of hope of getting it this time around, even though the Senate seems to be up for grabs. The other side of the coin, though, which I find fascinating, is that whenever the Democrats get the trifecta, as they did under Clinton, with the presidency, there's the Senate and the House, all three branches of government, which normally the American people split their vote between the executive branch and the legislative branch. But that happened in 92 with Clinton, but 2 years later, again, he got blown out by Newt Gingrich in 94. And the same thing happened, as I mentioned, with Obama in 2008, with the 2010 blowout for the Republicans. What explains that? It's as though in both cases, neither Clinton nor Obama seemed to get a lot done. The assumption is when you control all branches of the government, except for the Supreme Court, then you can really get things done. But that is not the record.
That's exactly right. And I think that is a recent phenomenon in a lot of ways. You know, in my book, I write about the aftermath of the 1964 election, which most directly, in 1964, when Lyndon Johnson won that huge landslide, he went on in 1965 to pass the most productive progressive legislation of any president since Franklin D. Roosevelt. So major action on voting rights, on education, on poverty, and he, of course, created Medicare that year. So just tremendous governing accomplishments when he had the similar sort of trifecta of the House, Senate, and the presidency with big margins for the Democratic Party. That was an era where when you were able to, when you controlled all those branches, you really could get a lot done. The difference now, I think is gets back to what we were talking about with your last question, is in the polarization of the two parties. We all know that, you know, after the 2008 election, Mitch McConnell famously said that his number one priority was making Barack Obama a one-term president. There was this idea that the job of the Republican Party was not to be the loyal opposition, but it was to be the sort of last stand opposition that would do everything it could to obstruct the Obama agenda from going forward. That was not at all the mindset that the opposition had under certainly in the Johnson presidency in the 60s, or even under the Reagan presidency, which was no, you know, ideologically moderate administration in the 1980s. But there was really a Democratic opposition that said, okay, we disagree on a lot of fundamentals, but what can we actually work together to get done? That is not the way that our politicians are oriented to think these days, and are even incentivized to think, so that, as you say, it really is hard, even with enormous inflated majorities for one party in control of the government, to really get a lot done.
Well, just in the last minute or so, then, Jonathan Durman, could this year though narrow even further with the third party candidates? It does look as if Gary Johnson with the Libertarians is doing quite well. He's up to 10% in a lot of polls, and he could even get to the 15% threshold, which would allow him to be in the debates. But he's certainly doing well, and there are obviously some disaffected Republicans out there who don't want to vote for Trump, and Hillary Clinton is in fact reaching out to them. And then you've got Jill Stein on the left taking about 5% away from Hillary Clinton. So could those third parties play a bigger role as, in effect, spoilers in this election?
It's possible. I think if the electoral map stays the way that it does right now, particularly where the battleground state polling really shows a huge advantage, more so even than the national polling for Hillary Clinton, you're not going to see a situation where they really tip the balance in the election. But it is possible that they would allow Hillary Clinton to win the presidency comfortably without getting a majority of the popular vote, which would then, of course, call into question the kind of mandate that she had to govern the country in her first term, even in spite of a substantial victory in the election this fall. So I definitely think the third party could play a significant role this year, particularly if, as you say, Gary Johnson is able to raise his polls even a little higher to make it into the debates and become a really plausible alternative for some of the Republicans who are looking to vote for anybody but Trump.
Well, Jonathan Durman, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks so much for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Jonathan Durman, who is a writer based in New York City and a former correspondent for Newsweek, where he covered national politics, including John Kerry's presidential campaign in 2004 and Hillary Clinton's in 2008. His latest book is Landslide, LBJ and Ronald Reagan at the Dawn of a New America. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.